all of you. And we are going to proceed. We do have some late apologies from members, and I'm not sure of the nature of them, but the committee secretary will, of course, give us the nature of those apologies. I do happen to know Honourable Cosby is not with us this morning, but then she's coming late. I don't know the reason for the lateness. Yeah. What I'm asking for in future is that when members say formally to us that they will be late, we certainly do need the reason. It could be that they're in another committee, and we practically understand that. Some people are sitting on several committees. But we can't simply, from a full member, say, yeah, that I'm going to be late. As a matter of fact, I'm very sick and I would like to be late. But I don't have another committee. I can't be late. So I just think these things are not entirely optional. So we do have to work by some form of procedure. The other thing is there are members who have what I can only call amounting to long-term leave of absences, where one sees them at Sona and the like and looking lively as anything. And the next moment, they have a medical apology or something. Now, I actually have a problem with these sorts of medical apologies, which only arise during committee work. I mean, if the committee work is giving you a medical ailment, we need to know. So that we can, of course, then research the matter. But we cannot take that any longer as an apology. And I'm saying this for the record, so that there's no misunderstanding when letters signed by me are going further than this committee. Now, having said that, of course, we have got what I call the solid core here before us. And I'm very pleased to have that solid core before us. Honourable Smiley Harris, Honourable Mabasa, who was just over there, Honourable Kwabasa, who's probably just helping himself to bread, and then Honourable Kadebi. So thank you very much, comrades, for being here with us this morning. And of course, the DTI are here in the full team again. I do hope you finally managed to get to the banquet or the dinner or the whatever. And but I do hear that there were lots of challenges around tickets. That's not in my area, thank God. So you are all very well kept.
Yes, Honourable
Harris. Well, Smiley
and I are very flattered that you referred to us as comrades, but I don't think we're there yet.
No, practicing for the comrades marathon. Not doing that. You know, looking at your weight and that, I thought you were on the track. We will be distributing a final program, which has been to some degree impacted upon by serious issues such as the time we can get in the house. Whip and I feel strongly, very strongly, that this cannot be a 20-minute debate, because it will reduce it almost to a rubber stamp and a yes and a no. So we are negotiating on that front foot. The second issue is the challenges that our own minister has on his time with respect to international engagement of trade, which we all want him to continue with. And these various, what do you call them, bilaterals, trilaterals, and multilaterals, etc. So we come back to this then this morning, and we continue with the deliberation on the amendment bill, and I have before me, as you know, at the last meeting on Wednesday, Ms. Herling gave us, alerted us to some of the outstanding issues arising from the public hearing that may have been, that we may have wanted the DTI to respond to, and plus she raised other issues. Now, you do have these responses. The DTI did take the opportunity, very limited, to study this, I understand, Ms. Lundgren through the DDG, and came back, and there are only one or two areas in which it isn't disagree, agree, etc., but which it indicates not clear or whatever. I think one or two of those comments. I just can't see them immediately, but they are here. And I think it's just two of them. One of them is certainly on page 6. Comment is not understood. You know, that's in relation to clause 67 of the bill. And there may have been one or two others. Now, as we go through this, what we would like to propose is this is fresh in our mind. We also have the responses from DTI from the previous meeting. I know, Honourable Harris, you were also, I think you could continue with your comments and questions at this meeting. If you recall, it was outstanding questions you had even at the previous meeting. And I propose that we go through this briefly, but let us conclude with any outstanding issues. Is that in order? And so, anything that you were not able to ask or comment on from Wednesday's meeting due to time constraints, will you raise your hand now? Do I see any other hands? No. So, in that order, Honourable Smother and Harris.
Thank you, Chair. Questions that I could not offer, maybe get clarity on today, and it was in connection with section 1362, and I would like to get clarity from the department because this will definitely have an impact on the prudential capital of what the banks are going to keep, which is presently sitting around 8%. And I just would like to hear from them if they did, through the Department of Finance maybe, to actually determine what that economic implication would be. If that should be implemented in a way that it is, it actually rises the question of the surety of the banks which they borrow from their clients, and that financial implication that it will have on the economic sector, because we might also have to want to look at the implementation of that certain section in fully and maybe just partially, if those figures have got to be adjusted or guarantees might have got to be provided either by our banks or by government in order to safeguard these sort of sureties or maybe issues that have got to be put into place. And I just that will be the one, and the second one is on the financial sector in order to transfer funding from our banks that are linked to their banks in like Barclays that are outside the borders of South Africa. There's an electronic system, the SWIFT, which they call the SWIFT system, which deals with the transfer of actual funding. And I also do note that our systems and their systems have got to talk to each other in order to transfer these funding. And it is my understanding that presently, and maybe with a bilateral talk that the minister is engaging himself with, that our system and their systems will not be talking to each other as it is now, and that could find it a difficult. It could put that sector into a difficult situation, and maybe there should be another avenue to be explored in that matter. Thirdly, this specific section 11, although it's got a big effect in various business sectors, I actually want to understand what is the effect that it will have on our CIPRO, on the old CIPRO changing after the new commission. Because obviously there have got to be made some electronic changes. And I would like to understand, because we wanted to give that sector a 3-year possibility interim phase to be able to deal with that issue. And I would like to understand from the committee side of you, from the department side, do you also need to change, or are you building a electronic system from scratch that will be able to deal with the system? Will we also need to give you yourself, CIPRO, later on when it's introduced after April, also a 3-year interface to be able to capture that information. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Harris, just before you come in, I have made a very, very serious oversight as Chair. That's because I do know him that so well, sometimes that's the danger. But I overlooked to introduce to the committee and to everyone here present the new DG, Director General. We knew we were getting one, and that is Mr. Lionel October. And with some of us met in Brussels with the SAEU missions and perhaps before, you are very welcome. And thank you so much for being here with us this morning so that you really become fully appraised of the deliberations that we're undertaking. Thank you, Mr. October. Thank you. Honourable Harris.
Chair, I have two issues. The first one is a technical question about phrasing on clause 16 of the Amendment Act, which refers to section 26 of the Principal Act, the issue of access to records. Chair, we've already discussed, and I think agreed on the point that the and needs to come at all, referred to the Commercial Access Information Act. But the other issue I raised 2 days ago was the right of a person who's not a shareholder to inspect the security register and the fact that they should then also be allowed to copy that register, which is in subsection 2. And I suggested that we should simply insert the word inspect and then, in other words, all copy. The reply from the department was that later on, in the final section of that clause, the counterfactual is established. So it says, to any record that a person has a right to inspect, all copy. And it's about the person that's failing to accommodate any reasonable request. And the answer was, if they can be sanctioned for failing to accommodate that request, then therefore the original right exists. However, if you look at how that clause is phrased, it says, fail to accommodate any reasonable request for access, and
the reason is, where are you reading so we're all on board?
It's on page 19 of the Amendment Act, the first paragraph.
Line 3,
under A. It says, fail to accommodate any reasonable request for access or to unreasonably refuse access to any record that a person has a right to inspect or copy in terms of this section. Now, the problem is that the person who's not the shareholder doesn't have a right to copy. So, to establish the fact that the business would be sanctioned for failing to allow them to copy, if that right to copy is given, the right to copy is not given. It is not given in the section, only the right to inspect is given. Therefore, the sanction won't apply, if you get my drift. I just think it would be much simpler if we change subsection 2 on the previous page, page 18, to read inspect all copy. That's my first point. The second one is the question I raised on the 25th of January when I think it was the DGG or Mr. Nishitendian requested that they would consult with the Department of Justice and get back to us. This is regarding the disqualified director issue in section 69 of the Principal Act. My question on the 25th of January was around a reply that I got from the Department of Justice referring to the applicability of section 218 of the 1973 Act, which deals with similar issues. I was asking a parliamentary question of the Minister of Justice. He replied and said, section 218 of the Companies Act, and I'm reading from his reply chain, which the Honourable Member mentions, is not relevant as it deals with civil action and does not deal with criminal convictions. So I asked on the 25th, if section 218 of the 1973 Act, which deals with disqualified directors, according to the Minister of Justice's opinion, only applies to civil cases, actions, and does not deal with criminal convictions, I would certainly value the Department's opinion on that, on the 1973 Act, on whether that opinion is correct. And secondly, obviously, it has then implications for Section 69 of the new Act. I mean, as I understand it, the qualifications deal very directly with criminal convictions. And I submit that the Justice Minister is wrong, suggesting that both Section 218 of the old Act deals only with civil action, and therefore would also be wrong if he said the same thing about Section 69 of this Act. As I said, Chair, on the 25th, the Department said they would consult with Justice and get back. I hope they've had a chance to do that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Honourable Salam.
Where have I been numbered that are being given? It is more proper as we speak to speak particular sections and subsections and not what is actually here. I have heard what you say, I can remember the date you have a question and it's a but I'm not able to relate that question to tonight and to the current status quo. Or what do you intend to achieve? What is it that you really want to be changed in the end?
Yes, in other words, I think a colleague is asking for your proposal then.
Okay, Chair, the initial question on the 25th was not a proposal, and it's not a proposal today either. It's simply a question of the applicability of the entire Section 69. The equivalent section for 69 in the 1973 Act, section 213, and I'm having an interaction with the Justice Minister about the applicability of that old section of the Act to criminal versus civil cases. I'm simply asking whether the same would apply to the similar section of the new Act. I'm not proposing a change. On the 25th of January, I was asking an opinion, and I'm just simply asking that again.
Getting, of course, DTR's responses here, but we also have our own state law advisor, and that is yourself, Mr. Oates, Advocate Hercules. Is that right? Yes.
Chair, do you wish me to respond to that?
Thank you, Chair. With regard to the references to the particular section dealing with the disqualification of directors, and with regard to the civil justification, the reading of the disqualification relates to the conviction and sentencing of persons who will be disqualified to be appointed as directors on a criminal basis, basically. And it just takes it away to our unconscious regarding disqualification.
One of the questions, or implicit in the question or comment, had been, in one respect, it had been regarded as a civil suit or whatever, and in another respect, as a criminal action. And I think the question arising from the member of the committee is how, you know, is it, in the justice area, it was regarded as a civil situation, and it would appear in DTI to be regarded as a criminal issue, and the clarification thereof. So, obviously, members are not necessarily right. That's why we're just clarifying the legal side, and then we also would get an opinion from DTI as well.
Check all the things on the facts before that, or that you have to deal with. So, it could relate to civil matters as well. The combination as well. So you can put on all the
as far as the state law advisor wants to comment at this stage without fully applying his mind, you know. So do you not want to get DTI's response as requested?
I would say just one question clarity. Just to confirm, would you say, that section 69 of the 2008 Act applies to criminal and civil cases? Is your opinion that the same applies to section 218 of the 1973 Act?
You see what I'm saying, Honourable Harris? We've just approached the state law advisor on the matter. Now, in my own experience of any of these lawyers and advocates, etc., that's why they charge a fortune, is that they want this time. No, I'm quite serious, and you know that. They don't give you an opinion off the cuff. So what I'm suggesting is we do get that response, but we allow a little bit of time just to that. You put your question, your comment on the table. Let's allow the state law advisor to apply his mind to the matter and not come back from the hip. Okay. Over to DTI.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Honourable Member, for the question. As usual, Chair, we'll attempt to respond to all the questions that are on the floor. But before we can do that, I think in regards to the question that was raised by Honourable Harris, we did indicate that we request not to respond to that question, and particularly because we were here dealing with the bill at the time, and we didn't want to make a response to a question that is that general, that is to say, you know, whether the view of the DTI and that of the justice are in sync or not. But we did come back to this committee. One of the things that we did was to check whether this provision is consistent with the other laws, that it doesn't deviate, doesn't contradict any other law. And that we came back and we did give the committee the response to that. Secondly, we did go and check if the provision is not inconsistent with the Constitution. That we did go and check, and we came back. And in our reading of this section, clearly there is a disqualification in regards to a person that has been convicted for offenses that are listed in here. So we would not want to go into the different opinions and all of that at this stage and say if we can be allowed to go into that. But I think we've given the committee, I think, sufficient in terms of our view in regard to this and what is it that we think it will apply to. And I think practice as well, case law has shown us in terms of what kind of an offense gets to be an offense that can disqualify a person. and we, so I think we'll leave it at that in regards to this particular question. But the team will address some of the issues that have been raised by the letter.
Deals with the issue of various languages being used in names, and it always been the situation with the registrar. They took names in various languages, and therefore there are no major changes or amendments to be made with the development of that particular system. So the system is ready to deal with Section 11 accordingly when the Commission takes hold on. Thank you, Chair.
I think McDonald has just obviously covered potentially the issue around Section 162. But I just wish to say to the committee that the negotiations that we had and the consultation that we had with the stakeholders were very extensive. And at the point when we came up with the draft, it was agreed that we need to express for the purpose of certainty to especially the banks that any action by the business registry practitioner that would lead to a cancellation of the contract should at least be subjected to a court process. And that has always been our understanding, except that it was not expressed in the law, in the act itself. So for that purpose of certainty, we have included that. So there isn't any dispute in regards to that particular area, because I think what we need to do is just to do the balancing between the purpose of the business rescue process and as well as the right of the banks to enforce their security. So the court process then seeks to strike the right balance between that, because I think the stakeholders see a cancellation as a much more drastic step than just a suspension, and that might affect their rights. So I think on that basis, we really have found each other with business, with the banks themselves, the banking association, and we think that the proposal is in order. Yeah.
Right. That was DTI there. Now, members, I'm just looking at you before we move on to a second process. We all seem. When I say satisfied at this particular, I just don't see a hand, member. This is why I'm saying.
Yeah.
Honourable Salah had his hand up first. I'm not sure if it was on the same aspect there. Honourable Salah.
I'm sitting here wondering what difference would it make whether we put you entitlement to a copy or we don't put it in the bank. I don't see that difference, because if you have got an X of access of information and you come to put in this X, that access might be true that you are giving a copy of what you're going to do. What are we really saying? To me, I don't think it's such a big matter of life and death that we should really be sitting here and reaching that short over. It is a matter of principle, it is a system, and the DDT refers to processes leading to court. Obviously, in court, people exchange documents. So what are we really doing? I don't think we need a debate around this issue. It is in class.
Thank you very much, Honourable Salah. Honourable Salah, we want to close up on this phase, so if you could come in quickly.
Yeah. I've got a different proposal from the bank that I've got with me on Section 136. I actually don't know what is happening behind closed doors, and obviously I haven't got access to any other information. But if there are any information concerning 136 that you guys did agree, I can read you one of the proposals that I've got, and that was handed to us, and then that was on page 15B, and which they court may not cancel any provisions of, and then it goes 1, 2, 3, 4. I don't want to read all those things. But those are one of the things that it said. But I want to come back to clearly to the DTI earlier. The earlier said there are some proposals that they put forward, and obviously as a committee we've got certain proposals, and I just would like to say to Chair and to some of the other honourable members here is that I don't think we would like to close a debate or an issue or a discussion on how we feel as parties or as a committee on certain sections. I think that actual debate will actually still come, and where we will, as a committee, then decide on certain on finalisation of certain clauses in the actual act, and then come as a committee with a final proposal on certain things after we've actually debated things. I think it's healthy to have these open discussions and that we exchange ideas and issues around about these things. And Chair, I would request that if there are any documents that was made available to the department later on a later stage after the presentation was made to us as a committee, and there were final discussions made with those groups concerned. It will be helpful if the committee has got something also in writing, because it obviously minimizes debate and the issues that we've heard them saying in that regard. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you very much. Now, what I'm looking at, and I think we may have collapsed a process inadvertently or in your perception. All we're getting at this particular point, as I say, is those outstanding questions or comments which you did have and which you have the legitimate time to operate with. The next thing, part, as I said, after we have that, it does not preclude in any way whatsoever the deliberations of the committee. All we're getting here are these responses. Now, at this point, it certainly would appear to me that we have certain responses given to us. We may not agree with them. We're entitled not to agree. You see? So we don't want to create a deadlock because they are saying one thing, we are disagreeing. We are, in the end, it's in this committee and in this parliament. Now that's why I say I don't want to appear to any honourable member that we're closing off the issue, but rather that we're going to have that deliberation. But I want to take it forward, and by the way, I have asked the State Law Advisor, our State Law Advisor, if you will apply your mind, having looked at all those acts that you were referred to, plus the amendment bill in front of us, plus the responses of DTI, etc., and come back to us with your legal opinion. We should remember one thing. The reason why we have so many advocates is that there are so many opinions. How many advocates are there in this room? No, you know, and I say this. Otherwise, you know what? We wouldn't need to run a court case. We could run it ourselves. You know, no, let's be reasonable here. So he's going to give us an opinion. He's not going to give us a decision. We're making that decision. I hope I'm now very clear. I think you know that, eh, Kimmy? Now let's go to the next page. Now, I was thinking about my earlier readings on Hercules was when I was a child of five, and you know, all the Greek mythology there. Someone read it to me, rather. But let's get back to this now, this process. What we had is Margot briefing the committee on Wednesday. You remember, and you kindly said, the department had the opportunity to study this in isolation to some extent. I say isolation. They did not get that same briefing. Am I correct, DTG? And so now they have responded just to the document. You have this opportunity, having heard from Ms. Hurley, our content specialist, what it is, hearing what DTI is saying, and I'm again not closing the deliberation, but offering you an opportunity with DTI to have that one-on-one quick engagement. All right. So I hope all of us have those DTI responses. Where are they in? number 30, case number 65. So now this goes to the next. We have our F.
Microphone.
Quiet line, quiet line. We have the X and we have the amendment though. And I hope we're going to be able, with anything you need to clarify or comment on, to get a further explanation, get it now. So let's briefly go through this. We're on page 2 of DTI responses. Jason, I think it must be the 10. Are we all on target? Right. Okay. Can we move ahead now? You'll see from there, I'll just do some guiding. There was something on the definitions, number 1. And you see the response was coming forward here, where there had been an inquiry from one of our people, which we then concurred to go to DTI, the same thing. And their comments, so you're able to clarify exactly the issue. It says here, whether the term fair market value or fairly valued should be used and defined. So calling, should there be this definition, the DTI disagrees and gives the explanation. So they, as they've indicated, you know, the FRSP may issue a practice note determining this. Therefore, DTI's proposal is that the definition be amended. Just looking at this. However, for consistency, the expression fairly valued should be used. Okay? Are you all... Arnold Smuller, have you got the right one? I'm reading from the top of the page, DTI response. Okay. It's rather small. But it's there. Okay, great. You know, they repeated what we, you know, the comment from us, from our content specialist. You see, so you've got the two together. And if you wanted further information on as to where that came from, you've only got to look up Ms. Herling's one, where it's got page number and wherever, you know, if you want to raise the question. Okay. So you should be keeping the two documents in front of you. Are we all on board? Okay. Okay. I mean, I would hope we're not going through choppy waters here, but let's go. One is definition, okay? And these are all issues pertaining to the amendment bill. It says, starts off, the DTI disagrees, okay? Jurisprudence around these expressions do not warrant either of them to be defined. As it is well known, in other words, well known expression in the accounting field. However, for consistency, well, however is what you should be reading, the expression fairly valued should be used. The FRSC may issue a practice note on determining fair value. Therefore, we propose that the definition be amended. So, in one sense, there's a disagreement. On the other hand, as it would appear to be some form of proposal. I wonder if you with us really see just the point we are making. So the DTI disagrees, okay? Oh, well, it just shows I better get my reading glasses on. It's so small then. No, very small. What's it, 9.8 points? I can't read that, you know, my staff. No, I only read 10 and 12 and 14. Oh, yes, sorry, I think I saw D. And I couldn't understand it when I read it. It agrees. So there we are, we're going with it, all right? Can we move? Right. The DTI does not agree with the definition we are asking for here. The DTI... fails to get a position on this definition, disagrees. I mean, it does not agree, okay? The definition in the Act is sufficient. That is their response. So unless I see a hand, we're moving. The definition of interrelated to ourselves. The definition is unclear, we are saying. The DTI disagrees. The definition is clear. Are you all tracking along? Are you tracking along? Good. I hear some talking, that's why I'm not sure. Yeah. But we're all on the definition of special resolution. The special resolution here. That was still under what we called 1D. Yeah, okay. The DTI disagrees. The differentiation is intended. I mean, the emphasis here is. Definition, we say, seems to have different applications to various types of entities, such as co-ops or closed corporations. We say that. The DTI says it disagrees because the differentiation there is intended. They want it to be like that. They want to show a difference. Okay? The definition of state-owned company, the implication on subsidiaries, etc. The DTI disagrees. Subsidiaries are normal South African companies, subject to the Companies Act. Right. Also looking at the researcher who is at the back there. The next page
brings... Madam Chair?
Yes. Well, where are you?
All the way in the back here.
Oh, that's a problem to me. I cannot see you at all.
I've been here all along. I shall see that you reply, Madam Chair. I'm not sure whether you would entertain a question for this clarification or possible debate. I'm trying to understand whether what has been said here is that it is a company, a South African company held by a state company would not be a state company. And if that's the case, how does it reconcile with the CMFA?
Thank you, Chair. I'll answer that. State-owned companies are directly held by the state. That's in short the definition thereof in the Act. Subsidiaries of state-owned companies are companies that are ordinarily incorporated under the Companies Act, and the Companies Act apply to them from the date of the incorporation till the date that they either liquidate or dissolve. Being that South African companies, if it's a private company, all the rules regarding private companies would apply to that facility. If it's a public company, of course, it will apply to them. But the subsidiaries of state-owned companies are not necessarily state-owned companies. The definition of state-owned company does not include subsidiaries. And that is why we say our normal South African company is subject to the Companies Act with full application.
Is that quite, Honourable
Harris? Thank you. I was just looking at the original issue raised by Eskom, where they suggest that the accountability and transparency provision in Chapter 3 would therefore apply to all of Eskom's subsidiaries. Is the department saying that that is appropriate? They believe that those conditions should apply to those.
It depends on on the nature of the specific company. I think Eskom has got an opinion there which states that all their subsidiaries must be dealt with as if they were state-owned companies, but they have nothing to say, so I don't know where they get the opinion from. That's why I say they are state-owned companies subject to the Act. If it's a large company, they will be subject to audit. If it's not, they might not be subject to audit. But they've got to be included in the group for the financial statements of the holding company.
Be advisable, the Act says one thing, it's there, defining it. Eskom's got an opinion from some advocate, fair enough, or commercial, whatever. So it may be in our interest, before we break down on our clarifications here, to ask Mr. Hercules again, to advocate, yeah, to also flag this one for us. All right. So, yes, thank you.
Madam Chair, the clarification confirmed the reading, so I can put my question. And it's not a legal question, it's a policy question, because we're looking at the desirability and the legislative process relating to this question. As I understand it, we have one box which says they state on enterprise. And to that definition, certain consequences attach in terms of transparency, in terms of CMFA, etc., etc. And as a matter of policy, as a matter of law, those consequences and implications are held to be desirable. However, if that company owns 100% another company, all those consequences and implications will not apply because the definition doesn't include them. And the question to the DTI, which is a policy question, is not a legal question. How would that be desirable? Because it makes a mockery of having the definition of state-owned enterprises. Eskom could set up several subsidiaries, 100% owner, which would no longer be subjected to the requirements that are placed on Eskom as a state-owned enterprise. And if this is correct, and if it is undesirable, then should we not correct the definition to make sure that at least 100% on the figure falls within the definition?
Right. Do you have a quick response there, DDG, or can you come back to us?
Chair, I think we might just want to have a quick word on our answer on this issue. But one of the key things from a policy perspective that we sought to achieve is that every company needs to be accountable. Whether it's a state-owned company or it's a private company or it's a public company, but at the end of the day, the issue of accountability is there. However, we were very cautious as well to say that over the years we've seen state-owned companies being in a position where they are required to comply to multiple requirements. For instance, under the TSNA, and then there will be the Companies Act and all of that. So you'll see that in the provisions in the Act, which we'll sign and point to the committee after our short discussion. There is also a possibility of exemptions as well, just to try and then leave the burden on double reporting. But I think the point that is raised by Honorable Amrodini is a point that we need to respond to, and then we'll just require just a few minutes to confess on it.
Thank you. Yes, DDG, Mr. October.
Yes, thank you. Just to respond to the policy issue about oversight and control of state-owned enterprise. I think the point is correct that the state, obviously through the PFMA and its other processes, exercise the oversight of the state-owned enterprises. The question being asked is whether it should also exercise that same level of oversight over subsidiaries. Now, Madam Chair, you will be aware that our state-owned enterprises like Transnet, Eskom, even IBC for that matter, have hundreds of subsidiaries. They enter different markets, they expand abroad, and so on. So there are hundreds of other subsidiaries. We cannot exercise oversight from a policy perspective over each and every subsidiary. It is the responsibility of the board of ESCOM to exercise oversight over each subsidiary. So that is how in practice happens. The IBC board exercises oversight over each subsidiary, and by law it is required to do so. So in that sense, from a policy perspective, we are satisfied with the provisions, and I think it would be completely too much for the state to exercise the oversight over more than its own state-owned enterprise.
We can later, within the committee, deliberate on that later, because now we've heard it's a policy decision that we've got that clearly from the DG, and we can discuss it later. If we may then move on beyond that to, let me just get it here, sorry. You're very welcome, Honourable Cotsy. We did get your apology, although we weren't sure why you were late, but thank you for the apology. On page 3, we have the definition of annual financial statement. We're asking, define to avoid confusion. The DCI disagrees. There is sufficient jurisprudence to define such expression. Section 30 also fully deals with AFSF, the annual financial statement, and the content and form. Right? As I say, our practice is to move unless I see hands. Definition of a juristic purpose. Effect of including trust within the definition. DTI disagrees it is intended that trust should be included in the definition for the purposes of this act. It is especially important for the definition of holding company, which is based on the definition of juristic person. And the effect would be that trusts who own all the shares of the company may in fact be the holding company for a group of companies. Right? I read that, I cautioned there, you know, because long explanation given. And then we come on the solvency and liquidity issue. Where assets equal liabilities, this represents break-even, should not be defined then as insolvent. The DTI disagrees. It refers to section 4.1a, states that if the assets of a company equal or exceed solvency and liquidity tests have been met. The DTI disagrees. Section contains provision that other valuations may be considered. As the solvency and liquidity issue keeps on coming up in this committee, I just want DTI to get over that again, because every time we come to deliberation, you know, we hit on the whole solvency, etc. issue. Did you want to ask a question, Honourable Smollett?
Yes, Chairperson, I think Chairperson, I totally agree with Ms. Herling's comment and what she's actually raising there, and maybe the department actually should I don't know, I want to say sell their point a little bit better, or come over a little bit better, or explain it a little bit better. But yeah, the issue of break even is, I do agree with it, and I'll let me leave it there.
Really, the request is clear. This could be done. You know, further clarification.
Madam Chair, with your permission, if I may, can I refer to the new Act that's on page? The new Act, Madam Chair?
It's on page 36, within section 4. The heading is Solvency and Liquidity Test. Section 4, sub 1. It is here where the issue of equal arises. What it says is that for purposes of this Act, a company satisfies the solvency and liquidity test. At any particular time, considering all, we can leave that out, we go to A. So the assets of the company or, if the company is a member of a group of companies, the aggregate assets of the company as fairly valued, equal or exceed the liabilities of the company. So if the assets of the company are equal or in excess of the liabilities, the solvency and liquidity test described here is met. So the argument of break even does not come into play. If it breaks even, the test is met.
Yeah,
Thank you.
Point of clarification. Unless I lost my mind, this 14.1A is to be deleted according to this document here. We had a discussion on all this, and remember I asked a question. And I understood the answer to page 3 of the document, proposal for consideration. The answer that you gave me, which I found satisfactory, is that the entire of A would be deleted and belong to the rest with B. And that was the import of this.
All right. Can I just clarify, Honorable Ambrosini, myself? I only referring to proposals for the consideration by the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry against us by Trade and Industry, this document.
Yes, all right,
so that we just know where we are here, and then the page involved is 3.
Yes, and then I'm not misunderstood because I did ask the question at the time in which I said, why don't you just eliminate any reference to the holding company? And that would solve the problem which was discussed last Wednesday. And in reply, I understood, having been said, that I misread the import of what was here, and that the entire A would collapse, which I was pleased with, and therefore we are only left with B.
If I may, Madam Chair, when we discussed on Wednesday the proposal for consideration by the committee, the proposal in respect of clause 2A in the bill, which is on page 9 of the bill, the amendment bill, page 9, clause 2, the proposal in that document was to the effect that clause 2A, as we find it here in the bill, should be deleted. So there should be no amendment in respect of this provision, meaning that the provision in the Principal Act would remain and would be unaffected.
I cannot put the question again. Then he did not answer the question I put on Wednesday for you, Madam Chair. But then I will, because my question was, why don't you eliminate certain sections? Okay, I understand now how it is, but the question remains unanswered, and we will need to deal with it in appropriate time.
Uncle Ambrosini, I myself am not too sure, because what I've written here is deleted. Now, which part of the question is not answered? Because we can't just leave it like that. I need to know what you're saying.
Okay, Madam Chair, sorry, I don't want to bring it back. The question that I had on 4.1A, going back to the debate on the holding company, is, well, why don't you keep the holding company completely out of the equation? I mean, each company is a juristic person. As it happens in most countries, the liquidity test that applies to the unit, and if one is fairly up, it's fairly up. What happens to the sisters and the parents, the cousins, doesn't matter. So I was suggesting to eliminate any reference to a holding company, so that we've got only one legal solvency applied to the unit. What your parents, siblings, is, you know, parents bear no fault of the children, children should bear no fault of the parents. And that's a rational approach in their nation. And that was my question. Why don't we just do it like this? And that question then remains unanswered if A is state, as it is in the Act now.
So I think when we responded to this question, we made it clear, I think, that obviously the cancellations and all of that would not include the group. And I think what the reason why we said the proposed amendment, the one that is in the bill, should be deleted so that we revert back to here, is that when you start using the word consolidated, it is often used in relation to the total group. So it might give the impression that the total group will be taken into account when you do your solvency and liquidity test. And so when you revert back to this section form in the 2008 Act, it gives us exactly what Honorable Anderson is saying. It does. If you read it, you see that it doesn't take into account the entire group, but it makes it clear that even when you are a member of a group, the assets that will be looked at will be yours as a company, despite the fact that you are a member of a group. So that's what it says here. So which is why our recommendation was that let's not put the proposals that we put by stakeholders to say we use the word consolidated, because that might actually confuse this particular process.
Magnus.
Magnus.
Honourable Ambrosini, we're flagging it. I hope you're quite clear. We're not taking it off the radar screen. All right. So if you could just put that mic of yours off or someone's right. Okay. Now we come back. Here, I've got so many acts up here now. All right, we're still on page 3. All right. And we just attempted to deal with 2, and then there were new issues. Did you see that? New issues. Limited to related persons to one degree of affinity. You may wish to go back to the Act here, isn't it, Ms. Hurley? There's a new issue. It's the Act. Do we want it only to go back to the, small family, as it were, or do we want it to go further than that? So if you, the DTI disagrees with that, in the section, Parliament concluded that third degree will be appropriate. And this should not be tampered with. The issue is sufficiently covered when the section is read as a whole. So we may just wish to look at the actual Act, which is on page 32, the actual Act 2008. And that's 2.1, let me just get the actual line for you, is that 51 or 52 there? So an individual is related to another if they are married, etc., etc., living together or whatever. And then it says here, limitless. Now, the Ms. Herding has asked for this to come to only one degree. It says, the stakeholder. Sorry, when I say Ms. Herding, it's because she's made a thorough study of the submissions. It's clearly not out of her textbook. So it's from the submissions we've had. I mean, I hope we all understand that. And our input. Just it's not in the Act or the Bill or DTI. All right. So I don't know if we can just move there. It looks like nobody has a problem with DTI disagreeing. Right. Okay. So then we go on to 4. And the four is anti-avoidance exemptions. Clause 6, F and 9, C should revert back to, on the next page, CTY limits. The DTI disagrees with that comment. Where am I? Oh, you've got them on two pages. And agrees with the comment. In fact, it did draw our attention to this briefly on Wednesday itself. It did actually. I guess we may have overlooked it. I remember them saying, look, that's a typo or whatever. So they totally agree. That's coming back. Let's just pick that. Then we come to number 7, section 12 of the Act. Amend the wording in page 12, line 17. The amending clause in 7C will be rectified. So it agrees here, so we don't have a problem. We've raised an issue for the submission term. The next section of the Act, amend wording in page 14, line 30. Again, there's an agreement. Section 10 of the Act, time period of 7 years may be too short. The DTI has a different view and believes that the period is sufficient. If you want to check specifically on what it is, it's the Act, section 10. Okay? Right. Then you're going to, again, there was, if I not recall, was this not also an area that you dealt with on Wednesday in some way? I'm just thinking it linked to some question. Then you go to the new section, section 15.7 of the Act, costs and capacity for SMEs. To review their shareholder agreements and memorandums. The DTI disagrees. The number of SMEs with shareholder agreements is not voluminous. Only conflicting provisions require amendments. In an MOI within a 2-year period, the cost is minimal. So we have that response. The 19 annual financial statements, AFS, mechanism for reporting irregularities for independent review should be included. Reference to future directive is unclear. The DTI agrees on the first part that indeed these reportable irregularities should be included. It totally agrees. The reference to future director is unclear. The DTI disagrees. It's an appointment made by the company, subject to the appointment coming into effect at a future determined date. So there it is, you designate someone, they still need to resign maybe from somewhere else, I wouldn't know, but they are going to be your director of choice, I'm just indicating, so they come in. They're not going to be the director now that week or whatever, but it's at a future date. Future determined date. My only question there myself would be, when one says a future determined date, are you implying or indicating that the company itself would determine the date? Because you're saying future determined date, right. So a date would be given that this person is going to become a director. Right. Okay. Yes.
Your commission. I think that the right way of saying it is determinable, not determined. There's a big difference.
Yes.
There is no specific date. There is determinable. In other words, it's possible to say around about when without specifying the date. It is just an overtime.
Yeah. But we're not sort of saying in the next 5 years. You know, we're looking at something being fairly reasonable. I'm just putting that to you.
Okay.
Number 19 on page 4. And now we've done that. New section, section 22 of this Act, the possible removal of the ability to ratify actions by directors. Goes is beyond the scope of the company's MOI. Ask for removal of the ability to rectify. The DTI disagrees this provision is in order as it provides the necessary flexibility for shareholders of the company by way of a special resolution to rectify any unauthorized act of the company or its directors. The new section again. Oh, yes, Honourable MC.
Just because I'm making notes, if I go along, a point of clarification, if I can indulge me, that this resolution is to be 100% of the shareholders. Or this preferred resolution is 75% of the
person.
It's an official resolution as per the Act 75, or as determined by the Memorandum of Corporation.
The MOI is a function of a public trust. It's a public document. It determines what a company is can and cannot do. And it's an element which deals constructive knowledge. Everyone in the world is imputed the knowledge of what's written in an MOI. When a company say we shall trade only in winches, not in anything else. People know that that's what it is. It's then something, if the company does something else and is ratifying afterwards, doesn't that create a public trust problem? I mean, people are have a legitimate expectation of relying on a company not being able to do that which the memorandum incorporation prohibited them from doing. And that legitimate expectation is breached if the company extends its power by virtue of a special resolution beyond the congenital limits that a term it has given itself.
Yes, Honorable
Mr.
Member. We are of the view that it is true that the director might have exceeded his or her power. In order to subject the very same thing which might have been exceeded, it is better to subject it to the highest constituency of the company, who will have to take that resolution for matter of corporate governance, that you cannot just agree as a director without going to the highest court of that or constituency of that company as a matter of corporate governance. Then we agree that some of the issues may be irregular, they must be rectified very fast. However, others are complexity. It may be good for the company to take immediate decision which starts with the director, and it must be subjected to the highest body, which is the shareholder, and the special resolution should be taken. And we think that creates flexibility, because if decisions are not taken fast, sometimes it may be self-sufficient for the company to be competitive. I think that is the rationale of our response. However, we agree that the public should not be prejudiced. That's why we have to go to that body to take a special resolution and mend the possible harm. That's as far as we can respond.
If I may add to what my brother said, I think the provision allows for where directors of the company may have acted in a particular manner, and the company may choose to actually not ratify as executive. But then where they're able to take accountability for what has happened, they can ratify that. But also, that provision is also subjected to a qualification under Chapter 3, which clearly says that only if such action is consistent with this act. So if it's something that is inconsistent with this act, they can't even ratify it. So I think the qualification does go a long way to ameliorate whatever dangers that or gaps that might exist in the future.
May we follow up,
Madam
Chair?
Yes, although we are coming to deliberations, but do there are you?
No, just 99.9% of the MOU in this world is a final clause under the powers of the scope, I mean, and anything else which can be authorized under the law. The law will be any lawyer drafting a memorandum incorporation will speak in the last provision where a company can do anything else. So what we're dealing with here, it's a true special purpose company where the people incorporating the company for whatever strange reason of their own did not use the catch-all provision and wanted the company to be limited to one line of business and one line of business. Usually when this is done is to protect the minority shareholders, those who are below 25%. Will not have a veto power on the special resolution. So by creating a provision of this nature, if there is the issue of public trust, and I'm not totally satisfied by the answer, but there is also an issue of minority protection, where one subverts the original deal which brought shareholders together and which underpins the very unusual limitation of the otherwise customarily plenary powers of the company.
Respond immediately.
Chair, I just have one comment. Subsection 2, the leading isolation, could have these negative perceptions, but one should read it in context with subsection 1, which clearly states that if an MOI of a company limits, restricts, or qualifies the powers or activities of a company, no action of that company is void solely by reason of that action being prohibited or limited. So if you read it in context, it makes good sense. Got to read it in context with our own section 20, because our section 20 deals with the validity of company access in a number of related and unrelated situations.
The next question I myself was doing a clarification with an occurring, which refers to a new section, and I'm suggesting just perhaps explain to myself. It is with reference to time frames between changes in the financial year in annual general meeting. The DTI's response would appear to be companies must be allowed in the financial year, which would appear to be the same as what is being referred to, I say it would appear. So I think I'm hearing if you can just address that for us.
Summary that I forwarded to members of the DTI on page 61 and 62, the notice being referred to, there are two issues. The one is in terms of subsection 4C of section 27, where the stakeholder was asking that there's a limit on the gain change by not more than 15 months. They're wanting it to extend to 18 months. And then the second issue was 2076. Where if the year end is over a weekend or public holiday, you would change the date. So if it was the 31st of December, but it falls on a Saturday or Sunday, it would then revert to the 1st or the 2nd of January. And they want that to stay constant and not shift if there is that kind of changes.
That puts things in context then for DTI. You
issue of the debt falling on a public holiday. We, I think we amended it. Many of my colleagues that showed me, but I think it was argued legally. We thought it's an automatic thing that if Christmas is on Sunday, then it falls on the next day. But the accountant maybe argued and then we considered on that. So I think we will have to find it on the day. Yeah. Okay, sorry. Johan?
If I may, Madam Chair, in the poll, in the amendment poll, it's on page 19, in line 10. Section 27 of the Principal Act is hereby amended by the deletion of subsection 6. Now, if we refer to the cap, page 20, page 72 rather, the heading in the middle there, financial year of company, section 27, subsection 6, deals with a Sunday, Saturday, Sunday, or public holiday. So the proposal is in the amendment bill for the deletion of that subsection 6.
All right, that certainly, I think, has clarified that one. Apparently, there is a subsidiary issue here. So if you look at 4C,
on the issue of 15 and 18 months, I think without being subjective, we said 15 is long enough for people to wind up with their
house.
Yeah, then that is subjective, but we think to allow a lengthy time, a lot of things can happen in between. So, but this is our proposal. Parliament can take the pronouncement.
According to them, there was some sort of tea available around 10:30 to 11. But now, we're not too sure because we're depending on your legs. And there's a switch. Right. Okay, well, let me see how many pages that we've got and whether we can't just have a rolling tea break for those who want to wind up at the airport. Can we just have a rolling tea break, or shall we give you 10 minutes? 10 minutes for those who want a little bit more free exercise. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think Dr. Some refreshment. And we need just to move on somewhat. I'm just looking around me. People are beginning to sit down. Right. Of a 60-day grace period to retrospectively authorize the issuance of extra shares. Right, everyone got those up? The DTI, I'm just looking around for the DDG as well, but I'm sure you've got the DG here and also a fairly full house. The DTI disagrees. A limit on retroactively authorising irregularly issued shares is by this amendment limited to those 60 days. The current provision places no time limit, and for good corporate governance purposes, a time limit is required. So the explanation now given there very clearly is that for good governance. Right. We then move to a new, is everyone on board on page 5? Right, page 5. New section, we're moving down the section of the Act, the section 39.4. Comment, grammar error, really, subscribe for fewer. That's purely an agreement then also with DTI. The new section is 41A. What is adequate consideration in context of that section, of this section? Adequate consideration. DTI disagrees. It is a board's decision to determine what is adequate, and case law will define it further. Including a list of factors will invite litigation, including, if one includes a list of factors, this will invite litigation. Right. We then move on to, hope everyone's still on board with me, and that is new section in the bill and in the Act of Section 45.5A, define net worth. The DTI disagrees. It is a common term found in the accounting field. Another new section in terms of bill. In the Act, Section 62(3)(d)(1) or I, forced inclusion of a summarized form of financial statements in the AGM. The DDI disagrees. Financials must be presented at an AGM in any form. Duty of every company to prepare financial statements. For preparation of an annual general meeting, shareholders will be in possession of the financials. Right? We go to another new section, Section 64 in the Act 9. Removal of the provision to allow a decision to be made when only one shareholder with voting rights is present at the meeting. The DTI disagrees. This is for flexibility and to ensure that decisions in a company are timely made. We then go to another section, section also new, section 66.8 in the Act 9. Split between remuneration for executive and non-executive directors. I actually thought that was answered on Wednesday. But I'll just read it anyway. The DTI disagrees. Section always allows for full discretion for a company to determine remuneration to direct directors. New section. Section 72.4. A difference of deference. Is that what it is? Deference. Right. Deference of requirements to implement a social and ethics. The DTI disagrees. Parliament has pronounced on the issue that same must be implemented. So one of our submissions was saying, I suppose, can't we defer the Social and Ethics Committee? And in the interest, I would add, of good governance, perhaps not. But the DTI did disagree. Parliament has pronounced on the issue that same must be implemented. And then we, yes, Honourable Harris.
Yeah, I just need some clarity on this. The implication from the submission in the hearings was that there was meant to be a 2-year lead-in time initially, and therefore if we'd moved the
we're going to implement the Act in 2010, we should have a two-year lead-in time from now. I wasn't around in the beginning. Can the department perhaps explain, was there a two-year lead-in time? And if so, does it not warrant one?
All right, Honourable
Ambrosini. Just if we can expand, when it says Parliament is pronounced on the issue of when, how, where.
Thanks, Chair and the Honourable Member. Thanks. What happened is that in 2008, when we approached Parliament with this new Companies Act, when it was a bill, there were submissions, and then some of the submissions required or requested that they should be specialist ethics committee. And then the matter was extensively discussed. And then there was no resolution at the NEDLAC level. Business and labor, there was no agreement, but the matter was placed before Parliament in 2008. And then the question is when, how? In 2008, after extensive debate, more so that there was no agreement, say, at NEDLAC level, Parliament has got the right to pronounce. And it was then that it was first that please, let's have a clause. And then it was adopted against the section. However, some of the issues had to happen at a regulation, at a ministerial level. That's where the situation is. In so much as our response in context, we request what transpired in 2008, please not to be changed. However, this is a proposal. If the matter is to be revisited, this is the same parliament which can reverse its own decision. So it is in that context that we are saying Parliament is already pronounced, because this is a section.
Right. I think from the parliamentary side, we'll look into that ourselves. We are Parliament. So I think I would suggest we pursue it a little differently then as well. Do you want to comment here, DDG?
So I was just wondering if we, you know, we should be giving a background to that provision. Yes, in terms of just the debate that took place in relation to the right of, for instance, employees to appoint a board member to represent the employees on the board. And then also there was the submission that talked about making is an obligation for the companies to comply with the NIJ to the Bill of Rights to be incorporated as part of the MOI. So the discussion went on in this regard, and I think one of the issues that was agreed upon is that there should be, companies must have some ethics, and how do you then enforce some ethics that would encompass issues of human rights, issues of environmental rights and all of that. And the Social and Ethics Committee was then a center of all of those issues. And so that is where it's coming from. I think when Magura says that Parliament decided at that point, it was having taken into account all of the submissions that were on the table. And what he's saying is that what is being asked right now is to defer the implementation of the Social and Ethics Committee. But we don't think it's something that really is so difficult to constitute that you need to defer. So that's basically where we are in terms of our proposal. Thank you.
On that further ourselves, all right? Let me go to number 45, clause in bill, section 75 of the Act. Application of same definition of a director to other sections in the Act. DTI disagrees. The definition of director in this section is restricted to section 675. The definition of director here is for a, specific purpose at this section, in this section. wider than the general definition of a direct right? So we then move to new sections in the Act, Honourable Harris.
Just to clarify then, since one of the sections proposed in the hearings was that perhaps it should apply to Section 69, which is one that we all know well because it deals with disqualification, can I just clear up then that the broader, as the department calls it, or wider definition in 75 would not apply under a section like 69, for example. Therefore, the 69 operates on a narrower definition of director than Section 75. Jeez, that is correct.
The definition in Section 1 of director is not as wide and does not include prescribed officers, for instance, as it does in Section 75. It's only for purposes of Section 75, which is the duty on directors to disclose personal financial interests, that this wider definition applies. 69. Section 69 has also got its own definition of director, which is wider than the general definition in the Act.
Thank you. We then go on to a new section, and in the Act of Section 83B2, requirement for an auditor to determine that a company has no debts. The DTI disagrees an independent report is required for the protection of creditors. 67. Section 115 of the Act, time period for launching of an application. Response from DTI, the comment is not understood, perhaps this is where we may wish to engage, but the DTI thinks that it is appropriate. Perhaps, Ms. Hurling, you want to just go over that section 115 where it refers to the submissions as well that were raised this.
During the submissions, Christian Weber Winslow raised an issue in terms of the 10 business days which a company must launch an application to the court. The main concern is not necessarily about the business days, it's more about how long it takes courts to actually finalize the application and give a resolution. That was on my summary, page 39.
That's that very thick, I think, one sentence. Are we ready, perhaps, for the response, or want to wait a while? Yeah, no, no, DDG, you want to consult with your team and then come back later? I'm not sure.
I think the team might have a response to that, sir. Because we wanted to understand the nature of the issue, because we're still not, still not sure about what is actually the issue. But I think Mercedes explained that
it's really not about the time period, the 10-day period. It's about the fact that the court process is, you know, you don't know how long it will take. And I doubt it is because getting many proposals in regards to the court. And we've got our own problems with how long it takes the court to make decisions sometimes.
No, I think Cindy, you covered it very well.
You do need the support of the mind.
No, thanks. Thanks for the support. Cindy covered it well. When we refer matters to the court, it means generally the two people that same level, they no longer have that issue of the legacy, then go to a third person. Whether the concern is going to, for the issue of operations, how the court operates, service delivery, all those issues. And if we are there, I think that is a terrain which really the DCI cannot pronounce. And then, then unfortunately we cannot pronounce on that. However, we would not like to keep business time wasted by going to court per se. That's why we come with the committee, coming with the resolution, the tribunal coming with the resolution. That is as far as we can go. The court is there for that decision.
Yes, I think we'd have to leave it there, and the very most that we could, as a committee, make a recommendation, because, of course, it is a difficult one. The executive, the parliament, and justice, you know, with the three arms of government and so on. But it is something we will flag so that a business, a smooth operation of business, is not impeded or negatively impacted upon. So we'll flag that ourselves as a committee. New section 11644AA, the FSB legislation obligation to approve amalgamation or mergers within the financial services industry. The DTI disagrees. Industry specific requirement is that it will always have to be complied with. Legislation is not in conflict, but is over and above such requirements. It cannot be in conflict, but anything extra is literally that, is over and above, as it were. So that's the response there. New section 118 of the new and the Act 1CI, comment from the commission's test for an effective transaction or offer in a private company should consider the number of shareholders. DTI disagrees here. The percentage shareholding applicable is the ultimate and overriding requirement. Section 77 of the Amendment Bill, Section 128 of the Act, the distinction between commercial and technical. We've been back, I know, several times, and very often it's because it sometimes, perhaps these days, can be a complex thing to understand because of what has been understood before, as it were. So let's look at it. It talks here about the DTI disagreeing. DTI believes that there is a sufficient jurisprudence regarding these expressions and how they relate to the financial sector. Okay? So we then go to a new section 13144A2, submissions according to the deletion of justification to place a company under business rescue proceedings if it has failed to pay over any amount related to employment matters. The DTI disagrees. It is a discretionary power of the court consider various criteria, including the non-payment of labour-related contracts. We have now another new section here in the end, section 1351A. Comments again from the submissions. Access to post-commencement finance may be limited due to the inherent risk of such financing and the available of collateral security. The DTI disagrees. In this context, post-commencement finance is not problematic, but only in reference to non-payment of employees' expenses. Okay. We then move on, and that is point 83 in the that of the bill, and section of the Act is section 136. The protection of certain agreements, such as clearing and settlement agreements, and securing payments for ongoing services. DTI disagrees. It is within the discretion of the practitioner to determine whether these contracts should be honoured or suspended. Yes, Honourable Smalley?
Yes, thank you, I was under the impression with amendments that it's under the discretion of the courts now. That the courts make the actual final, the final ruling, and not the practitioner. Like, you know, because this is it's determining whether these contracts should be honored or suspended. Honored or suspended. You know, it's how do you allow a practitioner to actually to determine just that and not the court? And I thought that is where this whole debate was actually surrounding, that the court has actually got the final say in this, and the response by the DTI here is actually not in coincidence with what I've been hearing the whole time. So thank you, Sarah Carter.
Point is made. DTI, over to yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Overriding factors in this matter is we must distinguish between suspension and cancellation. The way we did the amendment was to allow a higher process of regarding a practitioner's right to cancel a contract being subjected to the power of the court. When it comes to the issue of suspension of a contract, which is not a cancellation issue, then the power of the practitioner exceedingly has the power in order to. This particular answer is in relation to the honoring of letting the contract go ahead, or just the suspension of the contract. Can't cancel it, according to the example of this particular section. Cancellation is a reference to the higher power of the court being the arbiter and the decider of whether it can be cancelled or not. The practitioner does not have that right.
Thank you for the clarification. Maybe just get an Honourable Harris in there. Is this the same issue, Honourable Harris?
Thanks, Chair. I'm interested, what would be the downside of specifically protecting the clearing and settlement arrangements? What would be the downside of prescribing that in the law?
Now we had a problem with the length of time in court, but I'm simply saying that my task. Right, over to DTI.
I've spoken to banks on numerous occasions concerning
the issue of business rescue, they come up with a list of contracts that they require not to be involved in the business rescue process. And therefore, we face with the dilemma of which ones are in, which ones are out, and it takes away the power of the business rescue practitioner to turn their company around. Yeah. That's what the court has the power to deal with this particular, these particular contracts and to determine whether they should be honored.
I think the issue of business rescue should be raised in context again. The purpose of rescuing a company. I think what we appreciate is the sensitivity of the banks around the cancellation. And that's the part that we discussed. And in terms of cancellation, I think at this point, for us to then say that there should be certain contracts and then we list the ones that should not be affected and all of that, it will undermine the very same purpose of actually trying to turn around the company. But I think in terms of the being sensitive to the cancellation part of it, I think we agree, and we agree with the banks that yes, those should be subjected to a court process. And I think that's where we are at in terms of that. But the suspension must be within the power of the business person practitioner.
Right, members, it may be a value for us when we do our deliberations on it to go around this point, because a CEO came up on Wednesday as well, and we got a comment on exactly this issue. We've raised it among ourselves as well. So let's flag this for our own deliberation, and when we do meet court in ECR, that we call them back. Can we do that? Right. So at this point, we'll then just move.
Only because this is an issue that's been in the press quite significantly in the last few weeks. Can we not go a bit further? And I'm not sure if the state law guys are the right person to do this, but can we get a little bit more insight into perhaps the downsides of describing certain types of transactions? Because there's a degree of alarm in the market about this particular provision. And perhaps we need to get some outside advice on this ourselves.
You will recall, Honourable Harris, we do have an academic expert in this field, and as I say, when I say we'll flag this opportunity, we will utilise our own consultants as well. But that won't negate the request you're making, because we've also got Advocate Hercules right here, who's sitting in on the process. So I'm not asking that we put this into some sort of clearance bin, but rather let's flag it further for deliberation. It is an issue we should all be clear about. The new section 143 of the Act, the comment is, am I right, revising payments to business rescue practitioners to allow a minimal monthly fee with a bonus payment upon successful rehabilitation to accommodate SMEs. I must say, the moment I see the word bonus, my hair goes on end. But nevertheless, I'll have to contextualize it here. One of the students in rehabilitation to accommodate SMEs, which was raised, the DTI disagrees. Issue to be dealt with in the regulations. Nonetheless, the regulations may come with a differential remuneration for practitioners. So to some degree, as I understand your question, you're saying no, but yes. You know, they obviously could this could be factored in. Is this my understanding? Is that correct? Just want to make sure for the record.
That's an interesting question. Then if you understand correctly, that what you're really saying is actually yes, but none of your business. We'll deal it at the ministerial level.
Well, I
what it says, so we'll deal with it. You file and stay out of it.
Can we go ahead with DTI?
thank you. Yes, no, I mean, obviously there are some matters to be dealt with by the legislature and other matters, especially of detail and implementation needs to be left for regulation. Obviously there's limited discretion on regulations, but clearly on this matter, first you have to define what constitutes an SMME, and as you know, there are millions of definitions of when somebody is small, micro, medium, level of means, levels of payment, minimum levels, bonuses, is really dealt with in the overarching legislation. Those things are really dealt with in regulations. Obviously, the minister doesn't have a wide discretion. He's got very limited discretion to address just the particularities of a particular subsection.
I'm not sure, Honourable Ambrosini, if you got the regulations. I think we all did, and no doubt that these have been put up for public comments, if I'm not mistaken. So we can also look at them ourselves. Okay, can we leave it there? But as I say, that did come up. It's interesting. Can you just tell me who this came up from? And that was dealing with small business, small and medium business enterprises. Yes. Okay. I'll just take Honourable Harris quickly before we move on.
Okay. I'm afraid I didn't bring my copy of the draft regulations. Just for interest's sake, what are the fees in there? Or do you just refer me to the page, if you don't mind?
Right, they are in rates. I don't know that we were dealing with that right now because they have some public comments. But if they can help us, they will.
The
as I say, at this particular stage, it will be pertinent to see, as you say, half is dealt with. But of course, the public are for commenting on the regulations itself. Can we then get the next new section, section 145 of the Act 4B? A creditor that would have been subordinated under liquidation should be appraised and not become and not as a concurrent creditor. Just wondering if it was not as Margo or not, or whatever. So what's missing from that and not concurrent? So could you just read that yourself? And not as a concurrent, okay? The DTI disagrees. This matter was debated by NEDLAC. The DTI proposed to Parliament, and it was adopted when the bill was processed in 2008. So I'm assuming that this matter was debated by NEDLAC. Was the amendment bill itself, or was that also the Act? This is for me a clarification.
The Act is that. There was no agreement at the NEDLAC level. The labor wanted employees to be preferential creditors, and then vice versa. But the Parliament has to take a decision at that to say, yes, we are not agreeing. We think this is a workable solution of the treating the creditors as concurrent creditors.
Well, and then move on. We move on then to another new section, section 147.1A2. The practitioner should have the option to reject claims from creditors. DTI disagrees. This section only deals with procedures at first meetings of creditors with the practitioners. Dealing with claims will be dealt with during the rescue process. We then move on to another new section, section 164. Defer the introduction of the appraisal rights until after the 2-year moratorium for companies to amend their constitution to avoid inadvertently triggering these appraisal rights, okay? The PTI disagrees. The transitional arrangement, which provides for the amending of the memorandum of incorporation, is for the alignment with the provisions of the new Companies Act. To defer appraisal rights, there's no justification herein, and would revert to the previous company law regime. I assume when we say the previous company law regime, we are referring to the one before 2008. We then move on at this point to another new section, section 185 of the Act. Introduce measures to ensure the CPC will be able to carry out its function. The DTI disagrees. The question relates to the implementation of the Commission and is therefore a practical issue and not a legislative one. So that it relates to capacity once it's established, I'm looking at that. Another new section in the Amendment Bill and in the Act, section 2182. The application of this section is too wide and may lead to vexatious and unsubstantiated malicious claims, which may require the use of scarce financial resources by SMEs for legal costs. The DTI disagrees. The court can reject frivolous claims. Now, these are the issues some of you will recall. We are on Wednesday. Issues that initially there were gaps between issues raised and the DTI's response, but also other new issues, in other words, those issues which were raised in the submissions and didn't arise as it were before in possibly the questions or the DTI's response. So it involves the combination of that earlier document you have on two or three pages with page numbers. That was explained to us on Wednesday by Ms. Irving. Now, this phase, is that hand up, Honourable Ambassini?
Two small matters, Madam Chair, on the same thing. There is one additional issue which I mentioned to the DTI that I was supposed to give to the content advice, but I didn't discuss it with the DDG very briefly yesterday. So they noticed that they can answer, and they couldn't find the reference in the Act. But I am, there is somewhere an obligation for companies to provide a list of shareholders to CIPRO, and to CIPRO to record a list of shareholders. I know no other country which has got such a requirement of having a public public record of all the shareholders, and it's not sure where it can come from. It could be an old apartheid mindset. Is there a reason for that? There was an issue raised about this and the SAICA submission. Is there a reason to maintain that? Should we not take this opportunity to eliminate such an obligation and just leave like anywhere else in the world for companies to keep their own records? And we can share all that. And that's one issue. The other one is just my continual self, Madam Chair. I think it's wrong for any organ of state to assert copyright on its material in general, but I think it's absurd for the DTI to assert the copyright of the submission to Parliament. I hope I'll never see that again before Parliament, because it means we can't make photocopies that can give it to anyone. It's just it's wrong.
Honourable Ambrosini, I am allowing it, you've allowed you to complete this. But in my own opinion, I thought it was best dealt with as part of our deliberations, because I would certainly want to comment
but I don't want to preempt the points that may be made by DTI itself. They will certainly take us to deliberation, but they may comment if they so wish as well.
Sorry, I wanted to bring a new issue, and then now there is a response which if we want to respond, okay, we have got a discretion, but I think my colleague wants to give it that after that I'm the question that I raised, the second issue for the
government. Thank you, Chair. That's in relation to the list of shareholders that was should be provided to the Commission. There is no such provision in the Act. It's only directors' information that must be provided to the Commission. Shareholders' registers must be kept by the company, but the Act does provide that members of the public could have insight into the register kept by the company. There is no provision requiring companies to provide shareholders or list of shareholders to the Commission. In practical terms, that will be quite impossible for Commission to maintain a few million registers of shareholders over the country. You don't even try to. We won't even try to do such a job. Thanks.
Thanks.
I thought I indicated to honourable members, we're just at the beginning of the process of deliberation, actually. And I know that I'm certainly hoping that we will continue with the same relationship we've had with DTI, that they do send one or two of the team along during those deliberations and so on. Is this an outstanding issue, Honourable Harris?
Just a request to you. There were several, not very many, but a couple of issues which the DTI agreed to perhaps amend in their version of their proposal. Is there any way we could ask for an updated version of the actual legislative amendment that the department is proposing that's updated to include the ones we covered today?
Really, the request is on the basis of our capacity more than anything else as well. that it has proved extremely helpful to get it in writing, notwithstanding the verbal responses themselves. So I'm looking at yourself, DDG, Ms. Ntuli.
Thank you very much. We are willing to provide an updated document. There's a capable team that will provide that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And as I say, this certainly doesn't exhaust any issue we may come back to you on at all. I think I should make that clear. But for members, at least, we certainly have dealt with a load of issues which we've been fortunate enough to have content specialists identified. And many of us may have overlooked some of them. And they have been done. And now we need, among ourselves, to conduct our own serious deliberations. Some of you have been here for the most part, and it would be unfortunate if you couldn't stay the course, you see. And I think that everyone knows, or you know yourself, perhaps, to whom I'm referring, who have these unexpected exigencies. And mine is an appeal to you. Stay the course. We would not want to, when we're doing the consideration, for someone to raise a hand on an issue we have dealt with, you see. Because I'm going to say no, you see, because we've got this time. So please study it. We do have a hand start. For the first time, I requested the certain transcript of these engagements directly with DTI and the response. And I understand there will be another two coming to you. I think you've seen two already, haven't you? So those are also helpful from time to time as well. The information from DTI, I'm sure they'll get to us as soon as possible. I don't want to. I know that we're meeting, when is it, on Tuesday. Now, hope I'm looking at the right program. Tuesday the 12th, is it? That's the Manco meeting. It's Tuesday the 15th. We don't have a venue yet. That's part of the problem. The only reason for that is that we're trying to get size, the right size. So we've allocated at this stage about four sets of deliberations. This is the longest time we've set down deliberations in this Parliament on a piece of legislation. I'm not sure if you're aware of that. But we're doing that because there's a lot of complexities involved before we finalise our decision here with a consideration. The committee secretary has asked me at this stage to refrain from handing out this because there are one or two areas that we are negotiating with programming due to certain special debates coming up, like the division of revenue, et cetera, which I know you're all aware of. Now, at this stage, though, it is quite certain that we are having it on the 15th, again on the 16th, and again on the 18th. That is absolutely certain. And after that, you will get the committee program itself. And meanwhile, everyone knows that we're going to have co-op estates, etc., and that legislation, three of them need to be completed in the second quarter, plus the fact that we've got a budget debate, etc. So it's very full second, and you may want to now, from this moment onwards in your party, also be looking at the issue of the strategic plan of the committee. We've been through SONA, we're going to be getting the budget very soon, and we have not forgotten the NICS, by the way. We've linked it to ICAP 2, which there is a requirement that before, you know, the DTI come back to us with that. Our problem is we're trying to find just that right space at the moment. We've been given an assurance from DTI that a gambling commission report, now I'm just looking at the DG as I say this,
is on its point of coming to the committee. I just don't think there was a date given to me, if I recall at the time, but that is imminent. And the National Lottery Bill, Amendment Bill, which we requested in 2009, those of you who were here, that is also coming up for amendment as well at some point in time, along with the estate agent. So if I don't really wish to hear anything about really the mechanic and fixed and all of this until the estate agent's legislation come up. Hang on to these press releases. I'm glad I didn't buy through them. So just hang on to it. You know, we don't know what the court issues are saying, okay? But we will be dealing with all of those issues which may have led to that kind of environment. You'll hand this out on Tuesday. The final issue is, where are we going? How are we going to finish this? We've already asked the DTI to please assist us just by coming back with written proposals of what was said verbally. They've agreed. The content specialist will do a further linkage to type, am I correct returning, so that even that is linked to what we are doing. What you are required to do is to, now we're going to go clause by clause. That is not going to be easy for any of you who've done that. You need all your bills in front, you know, the act. You need the bill. You need your constitution. You need all of those documents here as we deliberate. And I'm appealing to you to have done your party consultation at some point now as we start going over the deliberations itself. So you come with informed deliberations on the matter as far as possible. Is that, are there any questions in, you know, in that kind of process that we're encountering? The state, our state law advisor, Mr. Hercules, is aware of some of the issues in the past today and has assured us he'll apply his mind and try to have it by Tuesday, if not Tuesday, certainly in that week. Am I correct? And you'll let us have it in writing.
Good,
Chair.
Thank you.
The other matter that we made, yes, the academic advisor, I call her the academic advisor, who is an authority on English commercial law, etc., is going to be looking at all the responses we have received, the challenges you have raised here now, and some of these issues, to give us her opinion as to, you know, what her view is as well. She has also agreed that once we have drawn up our proposed amendments, she will also look at those proposed amendments to ensure that they also synergize correctly with practitioner and commercial law. But we are going to flag the business, rescue issue, which has come up repeatedly here. We're going to be flagging the directors. I know you want to go and engage on that a lot. And we're also going to be flagging your, what is it, the commercial, the technical, insolvency, and the issue you brought up, Honourable Ambrosini, which I said I would have liked to comment on myself, you know, that will be coming up. Along with issues that we have to approach technically on the rules require us also to work within them, and that does relate to some of the amendments we are going to propose. And our committee secretary is going to take it up directly with procedure and the state law advisor, so that if it is essential that we have to, we believe as a committee, require an amendment to the main, you know, to the act itself, that's never quite emerged, we will have to undertake a further process in Parliament, you see. There's no need, you can quote these rules for me if you like. I'm not an authority on the rules, and I believe this is a summarized version, what number you sit here. But for those of you who are interested in the rule, please consult it. We need to ensure that this is not challenged later on from a parliamentary point of view, you see.
So it's not saying it won't be done. Do you follow? But if we say we want this amended in the Act, and we agree here, and we say the committee, you know, so you've got committee in support of it. It will go through. I'm not sure what happens if the committee doesn't agree and someone raises it. And that's what you gave to my house. You see, there are those issues. So I don't want to go down that route because I'm uninformed. So we may disagree as a committee. You raise an issue. We say, committee, our decision is X on that new piece. Committee secretary will ascertain what the legal position within the rules of parliament are. If a member then in the House raises the same thing, do you understand what I'm saying? And I don't know what that ruling will be. And we will try and get back to you by Tuesday or Wednesday. Is that in order? Yeah, and I am no constitutional expert on the land.
Madam Chair, it's all spelled out in the legal booklet. It's not that, it's much shorter and much simpler of what we're dealing with. We can amend the bill, and people can amend the second reading for as long as it's simply for our notice for the speaker, and those amendments come back here. Awesome.
But there for the moment, but the committee secretary will ascertain what the legal position is. Has advised me that we should go to the proceedings officer on the matter. So let me take that advice. I also take your own specialist advice on the matter because I do not have that information. Can we leave it like that for the moment? I don't want to delay you talking. So the venue, please look at yourselves, will be given there. Thank you very much for staying on a Friday. Thank you very much.
All Honourable Harris, yes. If you indulge me very, very quickly, I want to specifically thank two people. I think it would be impossible to do what we were doing without the work that Margaret has done. And hours and hours of work, we really appreciate it. And then the department's done some excellent work, particularly Johan, that when he ran us through all of those amendments the other day, I didn't thank him at the time, but it was incredible work. It was very difficult to follow, and it was a good job. So thank you very much.
Now, I think that's certainly a very suitable exigency. Thank you, Honourable Harris. And drive safely to the airport or home and fly safely.